And hello, good people of the internet. It is I, Tommy Kelly. This is Adventures in Woo Woo, and this is part two of the monthly question and answers vlog or podcast for the audio only people, in which I answer questions sent in from people from the Patreon and Discord, and I answer the questions to the best of my ability, given my current understanding, with the caveat that in the future I may change my mind entirely about my answers. I did have a part one of this, so that will be on the feed, or it'll be in the show description, the link to it that you can check out. And we have a few more questions that we'll just get straight into. It is, of course, meant to be the April question and answers, but it's now May, and such is time, so we just have to go with it. Gramp Pageoff, what is the first step a wizard should take after clearing Chapel Perilous? I'm kind of standing at the doorway watching for people coming up behind me at the moment, and it feels right, but I'd like to know what others have done besides declare themselves enlightened, which is missing the point entirely. Chapel Perilous, for people who don't know, is something that's been around, I think, since about the 1400s. But is most commonly how we know it now in chaos magic or occult spiritual circles because of Robert Anton Wilson and his book Cosmic Trigger, which is from 1977, I want to say. The first one, anyway. It's a trilogy, and I think the last one is sometime in the early 90s. But he talks about Chapel Perilous in it, and he talks about his own experience of Chapel Perilous. But what is Chapel Perilous? Chapel Perilous is kind of the notion or the idea that something happens in your life that you can either explain away as madness, or you can explain away as something that there's a mystery involved to life, that you see behind the curtain, that the veil is lifted slightly. And it's kind of very similar in a lot of ways to stream entry from the Buddhist kind of teaching, or something like becoming invincible from Gordon White's RuneScape Outlook, and many other of these things. It's kind of the notion that something has happened, that you've seen something, you've witnessed something, you've experienced something, and because of that experiences, you can no longer look back or think of your life in the same way as it was before. That it's kind of the first step, first place that you end up on the magic path or the spiritual path. It's, you know, getting to that point where you can no longer turn back because you've seen too much, man. For Robert Anton Wilson himself, he said that his one happened when he was reading The Book of Lies by Aleister Crowley in the early 70s, and it just kind of opened his mind in certain ways. And his response with what happens after you go through Chapel Perilous is that you have two options. You can either become paranoid, or you can become agnostic. And I think in the sense of paranoid, I don't think that he means that you can, you just feel someone's out to get you. But like in that kind of paranoid schizophrenic type of way, you know, that it kind of splits you up a bit in some way. I know that expression's not used in the same way, not used at all anymore. It's not deemed appropriate or descriptive enough of what that experience is for people. And agnostic in the sense that you can no longer not believe something, you know, but you don't know what's happened exactly. So it doesn't turn you into a true believer, man. It's that something has happened that means you can no longer disbelieve. So I think the thing to do then is that an awful lot of people, it seems, in my experience, just seem to think that that's the end goal. That's the journey that, you know, you've done your bit or whatever. You've seen past the illusions of life, or you've seen whatever it is, you know, you've awoken up in some way or whatever. But for me, I feel that's just like, okay, now let's get going. Let's start the game. So when you ask, what should you do next? Well, apart from, of course, helping people along the way that are in need of help, what is it? What's the next thing? You know, there's this kind of notion of the needs of the hour, and that's what your goal should be. That's what your next movement should be. That's what it should be. What is the needs of the hour for you? What is it that you feel is your next thing that you should be doing? And then do that. And it mightn't be huge spiritual, magic, huge kind of hairy, fairy, brilliant, kind of goal or whatever. It could be, I have to do the dishes. I have to sort out the relationship with my father. I have to, you know, get out of debt. Whatever it is that is the thing that has to be done is the thing that has to be done. And coming from kind of a theosophy point of view, particularly the works of Alice Bailey, which is where I'm currently embedded, it would say that all of this stuff happens in real life. That's like, say, your centers or your chakras or whatever it is, don't open by you sitting there meditating, thinking about them open and feeling love and bliss and whatever. Your heart chakra opens through forgiving people and working out relationships and, you know, through your actual life experience. That all of the spiritual learning, all of the thing happens here in the physical, because that's where it has to happen. You are bringing that stuff here, and by doing the forgiveness, by doing the love or doing that whatever it is in your actual life, rather than in the emotional plane, the mental plane, wherever it is in the different places, it has to happen here for it to actually count in some ways. Count's probably a bad thing for it, but for it to become an actuality. So what is the thing that you have to do next for you? Could be different for you, could be different for me, and then go with that. But just kind of see the Chapel Perilous thing as a start, not an end, because it really is a start. It's like, think of it in the old days of when you were in a band and you wanted to become the biggest band in the world, and the biggest thing to get was the recording contract. This metaphor doesn't work anymore these days because it doesn't really work this way. But, you know, to get the recording contract, and so you walk towards that, and that's the big thing, the big thing. And then you get that, and then you realize that's just the start. That means really nothing, that the actual work has to begin now. So I'd suggest that after Chapel Perilous or Stream Entry or Becoming Invincible or whatever label that you want to place on the seeing something or experiencing something or becoming aware of something or having an insight around something or discovering something that no longer means that you can see the world in the way you used to see it, then take that as your starting point and move on from there by looking at what is the needs of the hour and do them. Corvid. Some people on spiritual paths often say things like, love is the most beautiful force in the universe, or love is all powerful. What, if anything, do you see as the differences between love, defined somehow, and power, defined somehow, and why? This is a good question. I think in an awful lot of the greatest power of all is love, or, you know, the universe only has love, or the energy behind it, the universe is love, all that kind of stuff, particularly in the New Age, is kind of hiding or masking an awful lot of darkness and an awful lot of righteousness in a way that it's like people can kind of grasp onto this kind of love to cover a multitude of sins and different things. And especially when you bring in his love as a power and stuff like that, that can be a whole lot of, I don't know, an underbelly of way of using these words or co-opting these words or these ideas into agendas. And so that's one thing of it as well, with love as a power. Can certainly love can be used as an agenda, as we know from religions and as we know from various cults and various things that start off with these kind of loving intentions that soon turn into powerful prisons, I suppose, or mind prisons or social prisons or whatever that people can get involved in. What I mean, I suppose, by covering the multitude of sins or darkness is that if you look at a very like a fundamentalist Christian, say, because I know more of them than I know any other fundamentalist, to use their kind of religion or their sense of love or their version of Jesus or their version of God in a way to push a particular agenda or their preferences or their feelings about what life is. And then in that sense, that kind of love, if you want, the dark love becomes powerful in that kind of sense. It's not me who commands it. It's Jesus who commands this. Or it's my guru who commands this, or whatever it is. You can see that play out an awful lot. It's obviously not healthy and it's not good. And it's kind of co-opting something in order to further your kind of selfish agenda. And I think, I suppose, in a lot of sense, the difference between love and the difference between power is that, strictly speaking, love should be selfless, whereas power is quite selfish, in that love is extended outwards to people or to places or to divinity or whatever, but it's from you outwards and it's a giving, you know, whereas power is a taking. And so it's kind of the directionality is back towards you, where you are taking the power, you're in control, you know. So it's, I think ultimately when people say that love is the power, is that love will triumph over this kind of oppression. I think it's a nice idea, but I mean, does that play out in real life? Does that play out in how things actually work? And it's kind of seen as that the triumph of love, even in the face of all things, while on paper seems a wonderful idea, how does that look in practice? You know what I mean? Well, it depends ultimately on what your goal is, I suppose. If your goal is to show love or challenge power in some way, then maybe you're successful by letting power kill you. But if you're trying to do good works and change the world and fix the world and improve the world and evolve the world and spread love and make it, you know, where everyone is treated equally and all the things, you should probably stick around a bit longer and try and do that rather than some sort of show of how powerful love is by allowing yourself to die. Sounds like a bit of a slight on Jesus there when you put it in a greater context. So, I mean, I don't know ultimately. I think mostly, depending on who's saying it, it can be a mask for a multitude of darkness, or it can be a way of allowing evil in a sense, or allowing the bad things to happen because you've decided, I love will conquer all. Even this horrible thing that's happening to me that I really have no control of, that isn't going to actually, the love isn't going to conquer, but I can get my head around it and I can win even in the face of, of fatality. I'd be interested to see what you think about that, because I might be talking completely around what you actually, what you actually mean. The difference between love and power, the main differences for me between love and power would be that love is outward, the direction is outward, and power is the direction towards yourself. Big in directionality at the minute, as you may have noticed from other videos. Jean, if you could have been born into another religion, which would you have chosen to grow up in? This is kind of a bit like, I suppose, the question I answered in the last video, where Abraxas asks about, you know, your five albums that you would only be able to listen to for the rest of your life. And I suppose if you're brought up in a religion, you're going to rebel against it and reject it. So if you're going to pick a religion, it should probably be one that you don't actually ultimately want to end up in because of the rejection element that you're going to go through. Well, certainly, I feel a lot of us go through. Some people get very embedded and become, you know, I was watching a video just there about someone and she was saying she's a fourth generation theosophist. So it's possibly not as much rebellion in certain circles. So by that, I probably was in the perfect religion to grow up in because it gave me a grounding in the place I lived in, but it didn't satisfy me enough for me to want to stay in it. So it you know, allowed me to, or made me a seeker in other things, and that expanded then into all the other kind of outlooks and philosophies and books and theories that I get into then subsequently. The Hare Krishna, I kind of like, even though it's definitely a cult and it's definitely not the ultimate truth or anything, the food's really good, man. The food is brilliant. And I kind of like the kind of back, the element of Hare Krishna, the mantra, the kind of the play of God, the loving God, you know, the personality of God or something. There's something, seems to be something in it that in that kind of Krishna thing that I haven't found in any other religion, quite in the same way, possibly occasionally in New Age Jesus. Yeah, but and that would still fulfill the Hare Krishna thing would still fulfill the thing that it'd be right to reject it and move on and stuff. I'm happy enough with growing up in the religion I have and rejecting it. Just Max, following on from last week when we discussed the purpose of creation life in an abstract philosophical way, what have you been experiencing the purpose of creation to be lately? One of the biggest things that has happened to me over the last while is seeing my life and my experiences of growing up from the perspective of the other person. And that happened mostly through having my son and then going through the experience of being a parent and the ups and downs, the hardships, the joys, the learning, the toughness, the lack of sleep, lack of understanding, the lack of knowledge, all the good things and all the moments that you can never, ever be prepared for of pure joy and bliss and connection and seeing the most amazing thing you've ever seen in your life and it, you know, being your son. And so all of that, but what more than just that kind of general being a parent very hard, but also the greatest blessing ever, that kind of standard cliche stuff. But it's that it allowed me then to realize how my life growing up and the kind of traumas or dramas or bits of my life as a child that I felt were unfair or, you know, I wish had it been different or I didn't understand it or in some way would say blame parents or family or friends or whoever it was that was around me. Then when you go through that in your own, you can understand how people get to the situation where it's less than ideal and you're not the ideal parent and, you know, you make mistakes and, you start noticing yourself doing the same things that your parents did to you that you swore you would never do ever. You know, it's very easy to be a perfect parent before you're a parent, before that the actual nature of it, before it actually happens out. And noticing like on a bad day, through the lack of sleep, through, you know, the constant reiteration of the same questions or the same behavior or whatever it is that and my light got out, I'll have to fix that, but I'll finish the question. But even on good days, and you can find yourself making mistakes, that it allowed me to have a very much an understanding of other people in my life and situations in my life from the other point of view that I never ever would have come to on my own, just couldn't have, had I not had the experience of actually having a child and seeing it from the other point of view. There's no way of understanding, for me, strictly talking for me, other people may be able to understand this. I'm not saying it's an impossibility for anyone to do it. I'm just saying it was an impossibility for me to do it. I would never have understood my childhood from an outside point of view had I not seen it firsthand from a parent point of view and a child. And I think that's extremely eye-opening and it has allowed me to an awful lot more forgiveness and understanding and compassion and to go from, say, certain situations or dramas that I felt that were, you know, that were traumatic to me, to understand them and to have compassion and to understand that the people involved were doing the best they could, that there was no maliciousness to it or there was no kind of intent to hurt necessarily, that it was just, that's what it is. It's not to excuse then the behavior that if I do the equally shitty behavior, or if I do the, you know, the thing, but it's in understanding it and having compassion for it, it takes a lot of the blame out of it. And you can actually change it in a much better way because you're not kind of burdened with this kind of guilt and blame and shame and stuff that it's just you're saying, right, this is what it is. This is it is. It's kind of very similar in a lot of ways to the end of a philosophical midwifery or the binding of a process, when you see the kind of reciprocal relationship of the thing, and that you can see that in one sense that everyone is playing somewhat the same role. I don't think it's everyone's playing exactly the same role. I don't fully buy that. That there's a dynamic that happens in a certain way. And once you see the dynamic and the story or the beliefs that have been held, you get a way more compassion for the people involved. It has allowed me to see the purpose of creation, or I suppose the idea of this is the unfolding of creation in a greater sense. So that's been kind of my major sense of the purpose, or unfolding probably is a better word, of creation. So it would be in a sense of learning or understanding, and within the understanding and compassion to then move forward with it. Because until you understand it, you can't move forward to it. Until I understood it, it was just trauma. And then you can see it, and then you can move on, and then you can try not to give that to the next generation. So it's the constant improvement, evolution. The purpose of creation is evolution. So it turns out I won't change my light because the battery in my other light is also wasted. I am useless. So we'll just go on with the shadow. The windswept and interesting shadow. Crow, crow. Tommy, you are a very busy man. What do you do for self-care or just to relax? I have no idea how to just relax, Crow Crow. I have just no idea. It's not something I have an ability to do. That's probably coming from a need or a sense that you need to be productive in order to be worthwhile or to justify your existence. It's certainly something I have been given or adopted or whatever it is over my years from my childhood. Once a week, I go to the cinema. I do that. That's like definitely a self-care thing where I just get off for the evening and I go in early, just hang out, have a coffee, maybe read or listen to some music or something. And even then, occasionally, you know, as I did last week and the week before, I did a video while I'm waiting. So there's still an element of me trying to be productive within that. But my mental health and my general mental well-being is very much reliant, sadly, on hitting targets and feeling like I have been productive. And so when I don't feel like I have been productive, I can get quite down and aggressive inwardly towards myself. But when I have hit my goals that I wanted to do within the week, there is a kind of a mental relaxation within still doing stuff, if you know what I mean. But no, I'm terrible at self-care. I'm absolutely terrible at it. And it's something that I wish I was better at. But sadly, I'm not. Steve Machine, great name. What has it been like being a celebrity in the occultosphere? I use that term loosely, in zero pressure. It's nice being in a niche, in a small enough niche, that the idea of people who are interested in what you have to say, or you know, interested in what you do and stuff like that, that's very nice and very affirming. And you know, the support of people around me who, you know, literally send me money to keep going and to do all these things, or buy the books, buy the decks and all of that. And there's a kind of reciprocal relationship there where, you know, they do get something out of it. I like all that. I don't like people trying to hand over their responsibility for their lives onto me, which occasionally happens, not very often, because it's not just something I encourage whatsoever. And I don't like the drama that's involved in general in the occult sphere or occulture. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want to be famous, or I wouldn't want to have any sort of actual celebrity status or anything. Kind of being, you know, known by less than 1,000 people is nice for me, in the sense that it's validating that you're doing something good, or doing something important, or in some way changing things. But if you, you know, if you were getting 5 million views or something on your videos, I don't know, the pressure of that, man, I wouldn't be into that at all. I'd find that very hard to bear. What if you made a mistake? What if you said the wrong thing? What if someone misconstrued something you said? Someone once said that, you know, the fixer had told him that I've said this story a million times, but if you haven't heard it, it explains my fear of this whole thing, that the fixer had told them that they needed to remove their eye in order to get their girlfriend back or something like that. It's just like, I would be horrified if something I did where I was trying to bring positivity to the world or something, you know, change or help, some sort of help to the world, led to something bad. I would find that very hard to come back from. And that would be one of the fears of getting too big, is that your control of that kind of stuff goes, the control of your message, the control of, and I don't mean control in the kind of, it's mine, I'm keeping it, but control in trying to keep it safe. That I would find very hard. And sometimes when there's a kind of a push where things get slightly bigger, that's the anxiousness that I feel of this. Am I going to be able to, control's the wrong word, because control kind of, there's a negative to that it's not, I'm not what I'm talking about. Am I going to be able to contain this safely? So yeah, there was one, as you can hear my wee man outside going mad. There was one other question from Lebond, and it's about 5 or 10 most important or foundational books on chaos magic. I will do a video on that separately. It, rather than just giving you a listing quickly, three or four books, I'll do an entire video on it because I love book videos. And any chance for me to show you my shelves or talk about books, I will take it. So, good people of the internet, if you enjoyed what I had to say or you found any value in it and you'd like to help me out to continue doing this kind of stuff and to continue doing the comics and the art and the music and the writing and the newsletter and more videos or and all the kind of different stuff that I do, then please do consider joining the Patreon or sending a one-time donation via PayPal or buy me a book off my book list or join the Discord and have a chat with me or like and subscribe and share the videos. Buy a book, buy a deck, buy my comics, buy anything. So anything that you could possibly do in some way just to help out. So yeah, there's no necessity to do it, but it really does help out if you do it. So good people of the internet, until the next time, which the next video will be the divinations, the monthly divinations that I do for patrons, where they ask me a question and I pick a card from the 40 servants and interpret what I think the 40 servants are saying. And a lot of them find that really helpful. So if you want in on that, then simply join the Patreon, any level, and ask your question. Until next time, may your best days be ahead and be well.